Coming up in This Week in Computer Hardware, AMD Radeon Vega Frontier is here, people. Intel's 545SS is an affordable SSD. Samsung's Galaxy S8 Plus and OnePlus 5, we've got reviews. And mining-specific GPUs, they're a thing. All that and more coming up next on Twitch.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 421, recorded June 29th, 2017. AMD Vega Frontier is here, people.
This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by Tracker, a coin-sized tracking device that pairs with your smartphone and keeps you from losing your most valued possessions. Visit thetracker.com right now and enter promo code TWITCH to save 20% off any order.
Welcome to This Week in Computer Hardware, Twitch Weekly Show that aims to bring you the most useful, most engaging, most informative, and yes, ladies and gentlemen, even the most delightful news in PC, mobile, and Internet of Stuff hardware. I'm Patrick Norton, joined as always by Mr. Ryan Shrout of PCPer.com. Welcome, Ryan.
Hey, how's it going? Everything is working smoothly. We've had no issues in the build-up to the show recording, so I think we're all in a fantastic mood because of it.
There certainly hasn't been a giant blue screen of death involving my PC 10 minutes into the first recording of the show. But let us not be petty and think that
exactly
systems that don't crash during stressful situations are a problem. we were laughing in pre-show because the Radeon Vega has shipped. Has anybody, you know, done any testing on them? And then you reached into your magic table of tricks and pulled up
this thing.
That's the one. A little bit of hang time there on the Switch, but it's all about
building suspense. This is the Radeon RX. Keep trying to say that. The Radeon Vega Frontier Edition, which is the prosumer kind of in between gaming card and professional card landscape. This is a retail price of $999, so it's a $1,000 graphics card, and it kind of takes after the Titan brand in terms of how it's supposed to operate, right? So, kind of in an in between state, but it did launch yesterday officially. Like, went up for pre-order, went for sale. I bought one. You know, AMD didn't send this. They didn't sample anybody that I know of for reviews or whatnot. So we got it in today, and we're going to do testing on it this evening.
So, you know, is this the, you know, the equivalent of it? It's not a pure professional card, right? And what is kind of the difference between, say, you know, the Vega Frontier and the Titan XP, and for that matter, a Quadro line?
Yeah, so it's always been kind of a nebulous conversation because at the end of the day, the GPU that exists in your Quadro P5000 and the GPU that exists on your GeForce GTX 1080 is basically identical silicon. And the main differences come in qualification, come in quality control, come through software. Right, like the Quadro driver will only install on Quadro cards, and it has, you know, optimized optimized, you know, paths for 3D Studio Max, for Maya, for SolidWorks, for these types of professional level applications that require, you know, more individual hands-on tuning. And so that's more or less what you're paying for when you get like a Quadro brand or a Radeon,
a Fire
what do they call it? The WX Fire Pro, whatever they happen to be. That's more or less what you're paying for. And when NVIDIA launched the Titan brand many years ago now, it kind of was a little bit of both. Like, for NVIDIA, it had the GeForce GTX Titan name to it. So it had GeForce and GTX as part of it. But they all of their marketing, all of their messaging was that this is for developers. This is for people that are just getting started with, you know, AI development or CUDA programming or something like that, right? And this is kind of the in-between for them. But they still just ran GeForce drivers. Like, you still download and install the normal GeForce driver. But what NVIDIA got away with is that it was always the highest spec'd part, had the most memory, had the most compute units enabled, those types of things. And AMD never really had that type of solution until now. So now the just like NVIDIA, this is the Radeon branded RX Vega. Again, I got to take that out. It's Radeon Vega Frontier Edition. Vega being the architecture, the name of the GPU. Frontier Edition kind of being the nomenclature of like Titan, right? Mm-hmm. So this kind of tells you that it's not a gaming card, but it's not a Radeon Pro card. It is somewhere in between. Now, what we don't know yet is what the pedigree is going to be in terms of like its software stack. This does not use the Radeon Pro driver, but it doesn't really use the normal Radeon driver either, because it's the first one of this architecture, so it kind of has its own driver, but it's not going through the same qualification that you would require of a Pro series card. So this is kind of their in-between state. Now, before we ever started recording, I said I was going to do games testing on it tonight, and you kind of said, well, you know, isn't this a professional level card? To me, both NVIDIA and AMD talk out of both sides of their mouth when it comes to this, right? Like with the original Titan, it was, oh, this is a pro card, so you know, don't test it for gaming because it's not going to be a good value for gaming. So your performance per dollar of Titan was always bad, but it was the best performance of all of the cards available for gaming. And I think the same thing applies here, right? So AMD is kind of going out of its way to say, this is not a gaming card. Don't pay close attention to the gaming numbers. We still have, you know, the Radeon RX Vega cards that are going to come out that are going to be gaming centric. But there's going to be plenty of people that will buy this $999 card and expect it to do gaming, whether or not it's they do development right on, you know, at work, and then they play games the other half of the day, right? Like that's a very realistic use case. And I still think actually it's more trying to both of these companies trying to make sure they don't tick off the wrong people, right? If the gaming performance is bad, they want to have an out that says why gaming performance is bad. If its cost structure is poor, they want to have an excuse as to why the cost structure is poor. And that being the professional level or semi-professional level workflows that they're kind of targeting with it.
I mean, when you get into talking out of both sides of your mouth, which I assume you mean in a complimentary fashion that's designed to maximize shareholder value, PC World got an eyeballs on touring and got a little hands on time with the a couple of PCs with like Ryzen 7 1800X CPUs, 32 gigs of RAM, SSDs, 4K panels, Windows 10 Enterprise Edition, one with a GeForce Titan XP and the other one with a Radeon Vega Frontier Edition. And, you know, and one of the things they pointed out, like, you know, they were doing a car design. I'm going to quote Gordon Ma here. You know, with the Frontier Edition machine running an 8K Dell panel and a second panel at 1080p plus an HTC Vive, AMD opened up a theoretical car design in the SolidWorks engineering application and then did panning and spinning and moving. You know, then they exported it using AMD's ProRender plugin to Unreal Engine 4, where it could be used using an HTC Vive. And then apparently that's actually a workflow that a lot of small and mid-sized, basically AMD's like a lot of small and mid-sized engineering companies, they use this kind of workflow. Technically a game engine is not an engineering app, but it's inexpensive and it's much less expensive than using a proprietary visualization tool. And then they turned around and benchmarked it in Katia and Creo and SolidWorks and Cinebench and a bunch of other stuff. But, you know, it's curious to, it's curious to look at it because, you know, at one point we're all like, oh, you know, does it have the level of precision you need for a professional card? And that doesn't look like it's kind of like the big delineating factor, anymore. And this is also, I mean, this is kind of our pre-look at what's going to be coming in terms of the consumer Vega cards too. Our preview, I guess, not pre-look. I don't know what pre-look means.
I agreed. And that's honestly what I'm more interested in, right? We do professional level reviews. We do Quadro reviews. We do Radeon Pro reviews. But our bread and butter is gaming And so the vast majority of our audience is their interest in this is what does this mean for the $500 or $600 card when it comes out, right? Right. With the assumption being that the performance will be almost exactly this or very close to this. And it's worth noting that there's two versions of this card that have been announced, at least. I don't know if the other one has been shipping. This is the air-cooled variant that has a 300-watt right. TDP, so quite high. Then they have the water-cooled variant that's 375 watts, which as of today, there is no like specification difference between the two, which is very confusing right. to me because if you're running water cooling and 75 watts more, you would assume there's more power involved with it. So I'm still kind of waiting to see what that is.
You know, 75 watts, and an additional $500. It is 1.5 times as much as the air-cooled version of the card.
Yes, exactly.
Price delta there. I'm assuming yep. the extra cost for the liquid cooling system and the extra wattage is because they're running it at a significantly higher clock and giving you a performance benefit.
You'd have to assume.
You know.
You'd have to assume. And I've ordered one of those as well, but it my ship date was originally July 3rd and then the 9th announced the 15th. So I don't know exactly what's happening to those particular products. So, and it's, you know, I mean, we'll see, right? So I plan to have a review and story up by tomorrow sometime after, you know, depending on how long I stay here tonight doing benchmarking and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And we're going to look at, you know, the 6 gaming benchmarks that we've looked at over the last couple of reviews. We're going to look at SpecView Perf and some professional level applications. We're going to look at power consumption. We're going to look at noise. And then we come to right. some conclusion. Now, it's very possible that the Radeon, like the RX version, is nothing like this. Maybe they super bend and they're 250 watts, but they're super power efficient and their performance is different than this because of driver changes. I don't think that's true, but maybe. Hmm. And that's what we have to live with until we actually see the RX Vega products, you know, end of next month, early August. So
there you have it.
Yep.
We wait with bated breath, kind of a theme this spring and fall.
We do that a lot.
Oh my goodness. Something I wasn't particularly anticipating coming from Intel is the SSD 545 S series. Alan's got a review of the 512 gigabyte version. IMFT 64-layer TLC, which is a whole long title, but basically comes down to Intel's got a new line of client SSDs that are essentially low-cost SSDs, right? They're looking for an economical price point. So they've ramped up IMFT 3D NAND. This is the second generation that's stacked at 64 layers. And in theory, this should get them down to cost per gigabyte levels, quote, previously enjoyed by other manufacturers. 3D NAND was announced 2 years ago. A year ago, the IMFT capacity bump or the doubling was announced. And, you know, Alan notes that that's only partially happening today. The 545S is going to have the IMFT 64-layer flash, but the capacity per die is only going to be 256 gigabit or 32 gigabytes. So the dies are going to be smaller so they can fit more on a wafer, which brings down production costs, which is part of why they can bring the pricing on this. But we're looking at, essentially Intel packaging, a consumer drive, and the performance numbers are, of course, slipping by me because I cannot apparently click. Among the best performance Alan's seen out of a SATA SSD, very competitive introductory costs. But at this point, there's the 512 gigabyte version for $180, 35 cents per gigabyte, which is not bad. The 1 terabyte, 2 terabyte, 256 gigabytes, and 128 gigabyte versions are at this point not available, and no pricing is available on those. But, you know, from a consumer standpoint, this is not bad at all, right? 5-year warranty, rated at 288 TBW, which is a pretty giant chunk of lifespan. When you're looking at the pricing on that for comparison, a 500 gigabyte Samsung 850 Evo is selling for $160. So this is very, very competitive with that. PC Perspective Gold Award. And basically, faster than the 850 Evo in many tests and, quote, nearly surpassing Intel's own NVMe offerings and some of the others. That's a big deal because NVMe has traditionally been a fairly healthy performance bump over the standard SATA drives if your machine handles NVMe. Some issues at the furthest workload extremes. You know, it sounds like Alan's pretty good with this one.
Yeah, we're kind of at a point with SATA SSDs where you can't do much, right? You know, you're kind of pegging out the IOPS, you're kind of pegging out the throughput. So there's a lot of the discussion has to come down to cost. And so Intel can make a drive that is very reliable and high performance, matching or beating the 850 Evo. And that's kind of what you're looking at. Now, it is disappointing to see only the one capacity kind of available either for purchase or for review at once. And even though this is, you know, I think Alan puts it in the story, is like inexpensive for an Intel SSD, I would like it to be inexpensive for an SSD period, right? Like that's still the goal, is getting these down into regularly seen at 20 cents per gig and below. And this, you know, starts at 35 cents per gig.
Right.
So, you know, there's still some room there. No, you know, flash prices have actually kind of trickled up in the last couple of months. So, you know, it's, you know, maybe not the right environment and timing for that to occur here, but a good drive nonetheless. And it's one of those things where if you're in the market to buy a SATA SSD, you kind of pick your favorites, you know, 850 Evo being among them. This being among them now, and then you just kind of pay attention to when people have sales or deals or discounts, and then you kind of jump at that because the performance deltas between them are going to be pretty small at this point.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, some of the comments on this, you know, some people are like, "Oh, I'd go with a Samsung 960 Pro or a Samsung 960 Evo PCI over this every time," you know, which is going to be like $40 or $50 more than an 850 Evo. You know, one of the things Alan points out is that the 545S, it's basically for people upgrading from a hard disk drive equipped laptop or desktop, which in many cases don't actually have an M.2 slot, although that's getting more rare as we move forward, certainly at the enthusiast end of things. You know, it's, you know, the new Intel drive beats the Evo, the 850 Evo in mixed workload tests, and then comes very close to it in others. I'll be very curious to see what the prices are on the rest of the drives, and whether or not Intel brings those prices down, and of course whether or not Samsung brings those prices down, brings their prices down in response to this. I would doubt it at this point. You know, a Samsung 850 Pro is Samsung 850 Pro is $244.99, and the 850 Evo, man, you know, it's, you know, we act like it's expensive, but it's really cheap compared to a couple years ago. $172. I like that moment when you click between two pages and suddenly the prices drop.
It's always fun. That happens to me a lot on Amazon, actually, these days.
I think Amazon just likes playing with us. Yeah, and that's like Samsung 850 Evos. That's the number one bestseller in internal solid state drives. But it looks like, there we go. Yeah, 250 gigabytes for $105. 500 gigabytes from $172. Unless you want to get expert installation, and then things are incredibly expensive. But another option, I think anything that helps drive the prices down on this, eventually, of course, to Ryan's mythical 10 cents per gigabyte.
Correct.
It's an option, certainly compared to the Evo, certainly compared to the NVMe options that are available for your system if it has NVMe. But something else to consider. It started as an April Fool's joke. I actually saw one at E3 a couple of weeks ago. More accurately, saw someone dancing around with something that they claimed was one of these at E3 a couple of weeks ago. You actually have gotten one in the GeForce GTX USB drive.
Yes. And I'm saddened and excited to tell you that it was the most popular story on our website last week. And I don't know what that says about our market as a whole or me as an individual or our site. But it did get linked by like the official NVIDIA social Twitter and Facebook accounts. That probably amounts for a lot of that. So it started out as an April Fool's joke where it was a USB key that looked like a GeForce GTX Founders Edition. Right. And it was supposed to then have some code in it that allowed to do AI so you could it could control your game while you're away from your keyboard ordering pizza and et cetera, gaming jokes. But in reality, what they decided to make after the excitement about it was so big was they made 1,080 of them for a GTX 1080. And then they're giving a bunch of them away to gamers and fans if you have GeForce Experience installed. And then they sent some out to the media. They gave some away to people at E3. And it's really cool looking. Like, it's just a neat little toy. It looks surprisingly good to replicate the GeForce GTX 1080 Founders Edition. But it is just a USB 3.0, you know, thumb drive. But it's 64 gigs, and it performs okay. It's like 111 megs per second on reads and 48 megabytes per second on the writes. So it's pretty good for that, which you would hope NVIDIA wouldn't buy like a slow USB drive to put this brand on, because that would be, you know, that they would be made fun of for that for sure. So you can see some pictures there of it with the 1080, and you know it's a neat little product. But as far as I know, they're not actually selling it, so that is a little disappointing. But if you want one, go to GeForce.com. I think all you have to do is have GeForce Experience installed, and I imagine you have to have registered with your email address. Otherwise, they won't know how to contact you if you get drawn for that. But I've seen many people tweet me pictures of them winning them. So if nothing else, it is actually occurring that people are getting these cards
and are excited about it.
They are very much so. Goodness.
We should take a moment to thank our sponsor this week in computer hardware. It's brought to you by Tracker. There's a ritual to looking for your keys, right? First, you check the obvious places, the couch, the kitchen, the pockets, then the weird places, you know, the bathroom, the fridge, the hamper, underneath your child's bed, behind the cat's favorite sleeping spot in the living room. Then you start getting creative, looking at you, at that jar of pickles in the refrigerator. Don't ask. I don't want to talk about it, but it happened. It was not my choice to put the keys there. Why they were put there, I will probably never know. 8 years ago, Tracker changed everything when they released their first tracking device. And now they've done it again with the all-new Tracker Pixel, which is fantastic because it's like a tracker, but it's smaller, hence Pixel. Tracker Pixel is the lightest Bluetooth tracking device on the market. It can place a Tracker Pixel on whatever you tend to lose, your keys, your wallets, your cats. It's small enough to fit on your smallest items. It just kind of disappears on your keychain. And when you misplace an item that has a Tracker Pixel attached, you use your smartphone, and a 90-decibel alert will help you find it in seconds. It even has powerful LED lights so you can find your items in the dark. How cool is that? Lose your phone? Just press the button on your Tracker Pixel, and the phone rings even if it's on silent. You can even locate your item if it's miles away, because every Tracker user is part of the largest crowd locate network in the world. And Tracker's 30-day money-back guarantee means you truly have nothing to lose. Seriously, never worry about losing things again. Doesn't that sound nice? Go to thetracker.com and enter in the promo code TWITCH to save 20% off any order. That's thetracker.com and use the promo code TWICH for 20% off any order. We want to thank Tracker for their support of This Week in Computer Hardware. It's so tiny. I like
Indeed.
It.
Yes.
Indeed.
Agreed.
Oh, my goodness. Samsung Galaxy S8 Plus. Is this your new, you know, I guess Sebastian did the review of this. Are you coveting the S8 Plus after the review? Or are you just, comfortable with your current phone?
So, I've had the iPhone 6S, and now I have the iPhone 7 Plus. But every time a new flagship Android phone comes out, I'm always on the edge of kind of attempting the switch back, right? Because I was on Android for a very, very long time, until the iPhone 6S. So these types of devices and the design changes and kind of the unique capabilities that they offer, you know, doing things like having gigabit LTE capability, higher end SoC, larger capacities, 802.11ac, MU MIMO, Bluetooth 5, aptX for, you know, lossless wireless audio, amazing battery life compared to the iPhones and even some like the Pixel and whatnot, larger phones as well, is really impressive. And if you look through Sebastian's review, he came away really impressed as well. And this is a guy who looks at – he is kind of our primary Android and phone tester. And he had just kind of finished up the Pixel XL, which was, I think, generally considered the flagship previous to this one. And he is super impressed by the camera, the form factor, the screen quality. He goes into the Pentile display and how he – the Pentile display on the Pixel XL was very poor in his eyes, that it kind of made text blurry. This uses a different type of Pentile display technology that has much finer subpixels, and thus the text can be sharper. And obviously it has this weird aspect ratio as well of 2960 by 1440. Yeah, there's the close-up he took of the Pentile display there.
But that's slimmer for more awesomeness while being held in the vertical form that everybody but me apparently uses their phone in 98% of the time.
I'm one of those 98% for sure. I'm very rarely am I holding my phone in its landscape mode, except when I'm watching a video, right? Other than that, if I'm reading an article or something like that, or if I'm interacting with almost anything else on it, I'm holding it in kind of that portrait form. So the extra height is interesting. It causes problems as well with being able to reach the top of the phone with one hand. And, then you get the whole issue of, do you get the Galaxy S8 or the S8 Plus and what differences that may bring about specifically. But he kind of goes over all that in the software and, they were able to, if they implemented like the same type of thing that the iPhone has, where if you double tap on the button, it kind of brings everything down, not minimizing it, but kind of using half the screen, trying to make it more accessible to your thumb if you're using it with one hand. Which is super beneficial as well. The camera is impressive. I know Sebastian and Ken often debate about the oversaturation of some of the Samsung camera software features, but I don't think there's any denying that it does a good job regardless. And as I look at some of the sample photos that he includes here, I don't feel like any of them are oversaturated more so than you would see on other phones. Performance benchmarks look really good. The Snapdragon 835 is an incredibly fast mobile SoC, definitely faster than the Snapdragon 821, faster than the Kirin 960, which is the Huawei product. And then when you get into comparing it to the A10 Fusion from Apple that's in the iPhone 7, it's better on multi-threaded but slower on single-threaded. So then there's definitely pros and cons to that. Single-threaded performance means a whole lot for user interactivity. And that's why, Apple has some advantages there. In terms of graphics, the Snapdragon 835 is kind of unmatched based on any other SoC that we have tested, whether it be Android or iOS. So from a gaming point of view, it does very well. Looking at 3DMark benchmarks and GFX benchmarks and all that stuff clearly show the Adreno 540 to be very, very, very competent GPU in this regard. So good stuff there. And like I said, the battery life was, I think, the most impressive one to me. It has a 3,500 milliamp hour battery, which is, I think, the same as the Pixel XL, within 50 milliamp hours. And it's actually smaller than the Huawei Mate 9, but it's able to get, three and a half hours more battery life than that Huawei Mate 9 device, which is a lot. That's a significant, right. It's a significant difference. And I will agree, I think the iPhone 7 Plus has done pretty well for me. And keep in mind that those battery tests are a 7.38 hours the iPhone 7 showed is like these are tough battery tests. These are meant to be, with the screen is on all of the time and you're actively using it and that type of stuff. So it's not just like an idle time test or anything. But is an expensive phone. I think the retail price was like $850. That we pointed out last night that I think, I don't know if it was Verizon or T-Mobile, somebody's doing like a buy one, get one on Galaxy S8 devices.
Wow.
So, if you and your wife, girlfriend, brother, mother need a new phone, anybody at this point, it may be a really good opportunity to take advantage of that. Because it's a killer device. That I have now back here. Sebastian was very discontent when I told him I needed to return it here because I was doing some further SoC level testing on it. He definitely wanted to keep it. If you read that last page of the conclusion, I feel like he's directly talking to me about still wanting to keep it and being disappointed and having to send it back and all that type of stuff. So we'll see. But again, another good device that he was able to take a look at.
Oh my goodness. We should mention that today is actually the 10th anniversary of the iPhone. And the amount of chatter on that on Twitter and everywhere else is pretty phenomenal. Here's the iPhone that changed the world to the man who dreamed it and the people at Apple who have never stopped looking to its future. That was Tim Cook's tweet on the subject, which managed to thank just about everybody, except for, I think, the customers in under 140 characters. But it's also amazing to realize how that phone was the catalyst that kind of changed how we look at smartphones and what we do with smartphones in no uncertain terms. I'm still not upgrading to an iPhone that doesn't have a headphone jack yet. That's a little farther ahead of the curve than I'm ready for.
Understood.
Although it's been interesting to see some of the, you know, it's been interesting to see some of the headphones that are coming out with lightning adapters connected to them, including one more just did a lightning adapter iPhone version of their triple driver headphones, and I'll be reviewing that. Tech thing this week, we had a review of the OnePlus 5. Shannon got eyeballs on with that and was pretty impressed, right? Because it's OnePlus has been doing their sort of like mid-level attempts to do a flagship phone, but this is a little more expensive than the last few efforts. OnePlus 5 is $539 with 128 gigabytes of storage, 8 gigabytes of RAM, a Snapdragon 835, and dual cameras. Low-light photography, not amazing, but other than that, the camera performance is pretty impressive. For $479, you get 6 gigabytes of DDR4 and 64 gigabytes. There's no expansion on these phones, so, you know, go large if you think storage is going to be an issue for you. But it does have dual SIMs if you're one of those people that's constantly traveling and bebopping between SIMs in different locations. The performance on these is ridiculous. I think everybody's gotten hands on them. If you like to run lots and lots of powerful apps simultaneously, or lots and lots of powerful apps and switch between them, between the enormous amount of RAM and the Snapdragon 835, the performance is really impressive. The dash charger is designed to give you like a 50% charge in 30 minutes, not quite the Google Pixel 7 hours of charge in 15 minutes, but still pretty impressive because this phone is, you know, we just talked about what the Samsung flagship is costing. Again, this is a $539 phone, in the 128 gigabyte config, 479 in the 64 gig version, 1080p screen. I think it ends up being somewhere around 401 pixels per inch, 3,300 milliamp hour battery. Shannon ran like 6+ hours of video and still had 20 hours of left. That was with the screen on and streaming the video. Oxygen OS, which I'm a fan of because it's pretty much vanilla Android with a couple of subtle twists on that one. So if you're looking for all of the performance and you know, not having spectacular low light photography is not a deal breaker for you, this one should be on your short list. That's the OnePlus 5. Speaking of short lists, you know, we were talking about a mining specific motherboard a few weeks ago. Now you're looking at mining specific GPUs. Asus and Sapphire GP106 and RX470 show up. What exactly makes it a mining specific GPU?
Well, a lot of it is branding. A lot of it is, like, you notice there's no display outputs on that graphics right. card. So that's your first clue that this is not meant for typical gaming and graphics workloads. It's also it's interesting, right? So if you look at the NVIDIA based mining only cards that were launched, they're very specific about not using the word GeForce. They don't really use GTX right. in it. They're called like mining GP106 or something like that. NVIDIA appears to want to create a very specific delta between the GeForce cards and the mining cards. Now, for a technical differentiation between them, what this could allow NVIDIA and AMD to do is to take cards that had faulty display drivers, display controllers before, but the rest of the GPU worked fine, and now they can use those on these mining boards because they don't need to have a display output. Right, so this allows them to take silicon that otherwise would have been recycled material, you know, wasted, and utilize it in a different way. for AMD, there's a lot of discussion about the fact that, so if you look at their mining specific cards that I've seen so far, they've been based on the RX 400 series of products. So when the RX 500 series launched not too long ago, it kind of, you know, any RX 470s, 480s that existed were fundamentally less valuable then, because a gamer would choose, at the same price point, they would choose a 580 over a 480. So the parts are going to have to be discounted quite dramatically in order to kind of get them out of shelves and warehouses. If you sell the RX 470 cards as mining cards, you can charge the same amount for them. They offer similar, you know, almost identical hashing rates for mining capability. Some of them have display outputs, some of them don't. It depends on how aggressive they are with the cost structure of things, or how aggressive they are in cost cutting, I guess. And you can now take previously wasted inventory or previously much less valuable inventory and suddenly make it more valuable. So that's kind of the things there. It's, you know, some of it might be that their ability to, you know, cut display connectors off of it, maybe minimize PCB design, minimize things like flashy RGBs and colorful shrouds and things that might be expensive relative to the bill of materials for these devices, and kind of remove them because, hey, if people are going to buy these specific for mining, they really don't care what they look like. They just care about what their hashing performance is. Mm-hmm. The question is how many of these cards are going to exist, and will that have any impact on the availability of normal graphics cards to the people who want to buy normal graphics cards for gaming, right? The mining cards tend to have a lower warranty. They tend to, you can see in the specifications, they list how many mega hashes they're getting as opposed to clock speeds and whatnot. So that's kind of interesting to see. But it's an interesting option for people. Right. The question really is how many are going to exist? Like, are they increasing production to make specifically these, or is this simply a way for AMD and NVIDIA and their partners to very like efficiently handle the back inventory that they weren't able to deal with otherwise? And I don't really know for sure the answer at that point. We'll just kind of have to see how, you know, if the mining cards are a blip in the radar for the next couple of weeks as, you know, people get their inventory and move through them, or do we see this as a longer term thing where AMD is increasing, you know, output production for Polaris, you know, extending it out a quarter in order to make more of these cards and sell them to that audience? The other side benefit that you may get out of this is when the inevitable cryptocurrency, whenever the current cryptocurrency bubble pops, which will happen at some point, it may be in 2 weeks, right, might be in 2 months, might be in 2 years, whatever it happens, all of the cards that are used for mining start to filter back into the resale market. And that affects AMD and NVIDIA and their partners very poorly, because now your new cards that you have for sale have to compete against these old cards that are used that are going to be, you know, bottom line pricing as these miners try to make as much of their investment back as they can. The mining cards don't really present that threat in the same way, in theory, especially the headless ones, right? So if you buy a mining card from somebody, you know that it was used for mining, that it's going to have a lot of hours on it, like essentially like think of high mileage on a car. And so you're going to be less likely to pay top dollar for that. Cards that don't have any display outputs are not going to be useful for gamers. So that audience won't want to buy those either. So if anything, it maybe presents a little bit more risk to the mining community, because now you're buying this investment and their exit strategy of selling the hardware to gamers on the way out is minimized that way. So it kind of maybe helps out gamers a little bit in the long run. But the immediate help would be if they flooded the market with these products to open up the RX 500 series, the GTX 1080, 1070, 1060 cards to actual gamers that are trying to buy them for reasonable prices.
And there you have it.
Yeah.
It's an interesting thought where you think of the resale value of the card as being almost important as the actual sort of use of the card over time. It's a crazy concept. Amazon Echo, I did a teardown of the Amazon Echo, which is fun because you get to see the guts of what essentially is an Amazon Echo with a touchscreen and some better speakers. Will point out immediately that iFixit is a sponsor of This Week in Computer Hardware. You know, it's the teardown sort of, I'm not particularly looking for things you can repair inside of this. And of course, you know, if you scroll down to like step five, you'll see the classic glued on screen removal from hell. Cause I just hate glued on. I'm just going to say it right now. Glued on screens make me weep. But the, you know, the speakers are a big step up from the original Echo. And the big thing though, of course, is the addition, not just of the screen, but of the camera inside of this. It's pretty much right now an Echo with a touch screen and, you know, you can, anybody who has an Echo or the Alexa app, you can video chat with them, you can call them, you can text them. You know, if you asked for a YouTube video of fails, you'll get a whole bunch of YouTube videos that are numbered so you can pick which video you want to watch. If you ask this, if you order dog biscuits, you'll get a list of dog biscuits on the screen and choose the number of the one you order or ask it to choose one for you. Early reviews say it's a little bit buggy. Skills are kind of in their early phase. And the general consensus is they could use more bass, but the speakers are considerably better than the ones that are in the Echo. So, you know, it's, you know, the, I like the TLDR, in the iFixit teardown where they say, Amazon wants as much data as they can possibly mine. Their solution is to make cheap products that are too convenient not to use and to start soaking up those keywords. Enjoy the convenience, but remember that you're the product. Oh, and don't bump this off the kitchen counter or it's curtains on this show. And, it's an interesting idea. It's funny cause I was looking at a device recently that somebody was trying to put speakers inside of, and you have a limited amount of space. You have a limited amount of speaker you can fit in there. You know, but it's nice to see that they're finally starting to think of music playback as being worth putting better speakers inside of the devices there. You know, it's, you know, pulling 1.4 amps, 15 volts DC at 1.4 amps, so like 21 watts running inside the Alexa, which is a fair amount of juice for such a small device.
Yes.
Probably mostly, I would assume, for the screen. But, yeah, early reviews. Essentially, it's, you know, it's an Echo with a touchscreen for like $50 more and better speakers. So, you know, not particularly repairable, but not particularly surprising on that. You know, this is something that Amazon wants you to buy over and over and over again so that you have one in every room of your house listening for you. Just saying.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
I'll try to avoid that.
Stay tuned, ladies and gentlemen, PCPro.com, because the frontier, the Vega frontier review will be coming as fast as Ryan can benchmark, and go to PCPro.com to see his, are you going to archive the live benchmarking extravaganza?
Oh, sure.
People who were not able to see it in real time can watch you run benchmarks.
Yeah. In case anybody in the future wants to watch 2 hours of video of me playing, you know, six different games and four different professional applications. Yes, I will. We will definitely be archived for later viewing without a doubt.
As well, it should be. Pardon me for giggling, but I giggle sometimes. Oh, no. My goodness. If this is your first time listening to This Week in Computer Hardware, do us a favor. Go over to twit.tv/Twitch. You can subscribe or download or listen to all of our older episodes. And, yeah, you can find more of Ryan Shroud at PCPer.com. You can find me at techthing.com and avxl.com. And we want to thank you for joining us on This Week in Computer Hardware. With that, I'm Patrick Norton.
I'm Ryan Shroud.
See you next week on Twitch.